720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. Lots to do in the next hour, lots of stories to look at. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking about those nostalgic hand-painted signs. We see them in grocery store windows announcing what's on sale this week, things like that. A lot of those being made right here in Chicago, and we're going to be talking about that. And then a little bit later, we're going to be talking about advice for recent college graduates about managing money and finding a job and how to save and all that good stuff. But before we do that, we have joining us by phone Connor Daugherty, who is a New York Times reporter who wrote about something that is bubbling up more and more in the news lately, and that is the idea of these non-compete clauses. They've been around for a very long time, particularly as they refer to employment, but they, for the longest time, we really only heard about them when it was someone pretty high profile, a pretty high-ranking executive, something like that. But more and more, we're starting to see the impact of these non-compete clauses with more entry-level workers and how it's really, really impacting career choices and the ability to move forward in your career. Connor, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the program. Uh-oh, Connor, are you with us?
Hello.
Oh, there you go. There you are. Welcome to the program. Yeah. Thanks for being with us today, Connor. So this is a really fascinating topic, and it's surprising really how much this is kind of rolling downhill a bit and impacting even more entry level and more junior workers.
Yes, it's crazy. I have to say, when I first started reporting this story, I was startled with what I found. And when I finally found, you know, a guy who shovels dirt for a living makes $10 an hour being asked to sign a non-compete because of, you know, trade secrets, I didn't think it could go any lower. So
right, I mean, that is so surprising because, as I said, this is something we've kind of learned to expect, I suppose, when we're talking about senior executives that probably have a lot of really high level proprietary knowledge, but not so much someone who is, you know, I think recently we heard about this in like the sandwich making fast food realm and how many different areas this is impacting.
Totally. What impressed me even more was the lengths to which many employers would go to really enforce them. In the case of the Jimmy John's, which was, I'm sure, made big news there in Illinois, I might be incorrect about this, but I didn't get the sense that they really did go aggressively suing employees who they thought had violated the non-compete. But what I found was that in many cases, particularly, like, for instance, the dirt shoveler I just mentioned, not only were they being asked to sign these contracts, the employers were going to great lengths and really disrupting their lives and draining their savings, filing lawsuits against them, making them fight back. It was really impressive that they aren't just pieces of paper used to intimidate you. They really will go after you in some cases.
Right, because it's going to be harder for employees to move forward. I mean, so often you hear about someone has made a big leap forward in their career by going to a competitor. And as you point out in the story that you wrote for New York Times, how often you bring members of your team with you when you jump ship and go to the competitor. That's kind of how it's gone for the longest time. But suddenly this would really, you know, these being enforced so widely and so to such extents really has the potential anyway to impact career plans in a very profound way. And some of them you've written about people that really, really lost quite a bit as a result of these.
Yeah. And I think most of us get raises a couple times in our lives. You know, maybe we get a little raise every year, or, you know, in good times we get a couple percent, but really there's like four or five couple events usually involved with a big promotion or leaving a company that really dictate and our earnings trajectory over our entire lifetimes. And if you mess up one or two of those little moves, it can impact you your whole life. It's if you think about how we all get raises, it's usually that way. And it makes some sense, right? Because, like, let's say you're working at a company, your boss is very young, very good, I'm just making this up, and you see an opportunity for advancement, you know, say you're blocked there in a way, not for bad reasons, but just because there's a good person in the job, mm-hmm. and you see an opportunity to advance with another company, well, that's kind of naturally how it should go. But, you know, this, as you point out, this really gets in the way. I think the other thing, and as you kind of mentioned, is work is very social now. You know, we probably always was, but we go and we follow our friends, we find new situations with people we like. And it's not only that there are non-compete agreements, there's now like these non-poaching agreements, like non-recruitment agreements. And it's like they tend to block off every way we know that you get a job, right? Like how, you go to a competitor in the industry you know a little bit something about, or you follow a friend. You know, like all these, who really gets a job by saying, oh, I want to go to this industry I know nothing about, and I'm going to go interview with someone I've never met in a state I know I've never lived in. You know, I suppose that happens from time to time, but it's not like the normal way.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Right, right. And as you point out in the story also, there's a lot of companies that are dismissing this a bit and downplaying it, just kind of saying, well, this is a natural reaction in an economy where that's more about knowledge than it is about physical labor. But I've got to believe it's a lot more nuanced than that.
It's much more nuanced. And as I mentioned in the story, a lot of people think that the development of the Silicon Valley was a result largely a result of the fact that non-competes are totally unenforceable in California. You would think that in Silicon Valley, where people have all this specialized knowledge, that you'd see these things being enforced left and right. And actually, the opposite is true. And that's just because of this sort of quirk in California law. But I think one thing that we tend to forget is that it really helps us as a society to have knowledge spreading around. I know it's not good for individual companies, but it is totally good for us as a country. People are borrowing ideas from people constantly, but they're not just stealing them. They're refining them. They're turning them into better products. They're, you know, I mean, sort of. And getting knowledge out there just pushes us forward it forces us to innovate more quickly. And I think it's great. I understand that companies have to protect their secrets, but we have to find some balance between moving us forward in knowledge and spreading it around so that different companies can innovate in all sorts of different ways that we might not have even contemplated. And, you know, protecting a company's secrets. And I think that California, I mean, it's not like anyone can claim that there's been a shortage of money created with, you know, ideas in California. You know, so it seems to sort of work out.
Right, right. And you know what? As you were saying that, I immediately, what came to mind was that that TED Talk, there was an animated version of it that Steven Johnson did about where ideas come from, about how knowledge spreads, and so much is about the collision of ideas, not just in one person's head. And he points to so many major innovation moments in which it was about paths crossing and not just one person sitting in a room staring at a whiteboard or something like that. So indeed, as you point out, it's good for us, for our ideas to spread around. So California, California law prohibits non-compete clauses. Are there other states that are starting to look at this? It seems like this conversation is swelling up a bit in Massachusetts, but it's interesting how it's manifesting kind of on both sides of the aisle.
I think I have to say the both sides of the aisle is like one of my favorite things about this story, because you could say from an arch libertarian perspective, we should have no non-competes. And you could say from a very liberal perspective, we should have no non-competes. It's only this like kind of country clubbish, cronyish kind of philosophy that says that's where you tend to find it. But so Utah passed a law that made it a little bit more difficult to Utah, which I should note is totally dominated by Republicans, passed a law that makes it more difficult to enforce non-competes, and it essentially forces the employer who files a lawsuit against the employee to pay if they lose. So it really discourages them from even going after people in the first place. Massachusetts has had this debate last year. They came about as close as you could come to passing it without passing it, and it's going to bubble up again this year. And you're seeing this, all sorts of different states look at this in different ways, either from the AG level or the legislative level. And, you know, you hear from state to state to state, oh, we want more knowledge jobs. We want more high-level, entrepreneurs. We want all those things. Well, making it easier for people to defect is like one of the best ways you can get all those things you want. And, you know, it's funny. It's this weird thing for legislators. It's almost like a existential question, which is how do you create the conditions for people to create the jobs of tomorrow when you don't even really know what they are?
Mm-hmm.
and when you're facing resistance from the people who have the jobs of today. It's like this really weird, difficult question, but it's like totally crucial to how we move forward as an economy and workforce.
Right. So as you were putting this story together and doing all this reporting, did you get the sense that we are just beginning this journey into this highly enforced era of highly enforced non-compete clauses? Or do you think we're going to shift into a different spot here?
That's an excellent question. It feels like the tide is generally moving against making it easier to enforce them. And when you put, there are some exceptions to that, stay tuned. But I find that when you talk to anybody about this, when they hear the actual stories, they get very uncomfortable with it, you know, especially since a lot of these people who get prohibited from working go and are on Medicaid or food stamps or, you know, unemployment insurance. Not because they can't find a job, but because they're like, old employer won't let them have one.
Right.
Now, one thing you didn't mention, by the way, which is like people, their eyes pop out of their head when they hear it. These non-competes are enforceable even when you've been laid off. So I talked to numerous people who were laid off from a company, and then they had a non-compete. They said, oh, yeah, you know, you can't go apply to a job at the other company. And it's this, I mean, that's just like really hard to fathom.
Yeah.
You know, some lawyers will say, well, you know, the company has been having this is a sort of difficult thing to say, right? But a lot of lawyers will say, well, that company's having financial trouble and they laid off important people. And if those important people go to the competitor, they might have more financial trouble. I suppose that intellectually makes sense. But one of the things we forget is that, again, this is a harsh thing to say, we kind of want weak companies to die. Our economy thrives on people moving to the places where growth is, where innovation's happening. You know, Yahoo basically died. I'm sure it was eventually but now we have Google and it's so much, you know, so
yeah.
We kind of like want that process to happen, and we want those people to be going to new prosperous companies and finding their talents and, you know, all that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's like the natural selection of companies. It's kind of that
right?
Same system.
Yeah.
It's also interesting. Everybody head to NewYorkTimes.com and read the story. It's a long and wonderful read by our guest, Connor Daugherty, reporter there at New York Times. Connor, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Have a great weekend. All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news here in a little while and all that good stuff, but plenty more to talk about here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your sunny and gorgeous Saturday with us. Most grateful to you for that. Hope you are able to get outside and enjoy some of this gorgeous weather. As I love to say, your February self will thank you for doing that, because we can just reminisce about this gorgeous weather when it's freezing here. Speaking of reminiscing, there is a cool story at Chicago Tribune. It is about, you know, those hand-painted signs that used to be in every grocery store, and then as really big chain grocery stores started coming in, we saw them less and less, and they would see, you know, they'd have like more corporate distributed signage. But some of those great grocery stores that are still around in Chicago, that I'm thinking of, like Stanley's Produce on Elston, and there's just a smattering of fabulous grocery stores that I love to support here in Chicago that are really, really great. But they saw those cool paper hand-painted signs that change out week to week. There is a story in Chicago Tribune all about that. And as much as we talk about technology and very, very, big business and mass-produced things, I thought this story was very, very cool to look at the handmade, and especially the handmade right here in Chicago, because there's a really interesting, in particular, this reporter, Ali Murati, is sort of looking at a particular sign company called Southwest Signs, based in Logan Square here in Chicago, and how quickly that cycle goes. And I think it's so interesting, kind of a, you get that order Wednesday, they do it Thursday, they're delivered Friday so that the sale can start in time for the weekend.
Yeah, and mistakes are like crucial.
It right.
costs money and time.
I love
it.
Which
is just as valuable. It was so fun to go through this. Yeah, people should look it up at ChicagoTribune.com. And
the art
is so beautiful.
It's so beautiful.
The photos are, and it's the kind of thing that you've seen so many times, you might not think about it on the street, but when you're looking at it in this context, I was like, oh man,
it's an
gorgeous.
Art. Yeah, it's really, really beautiful. And it's one of those things, once you read the story, suddenly signs look very different to you, because you realize, wow, someone had to, time is money for this person, but it's not mass produced. It's done by hand. And as you said, Griffin, with a, you know, you misspell, you know, you don't put that I before E or something, you know,
yeah.
you misspell something and it's shot. And
yeah. And Oscar Mayer Wiener, that's what they start with.
Yeah. That was the example in the story in which it's, they're trying to figure out how to spell that. So they go and Google it to make sure. You'd have to Google constantly, be, you know, spell checking yourself to make sure. And I just thought it was such a charming story, because, you know, we think of signs being done on a big printer with, you know, graphic design and all that. And that's a very worthy endeavor. And I certainly don't have any design skills, so I admire anyone who can do that. But the idea of just kind of being there in a studio with these giant pieces of paper and paint and a paintbrush, and just freehanding these signs, Jaiba Carrots are on sale, but still making them look very, very beautiful, even though it's only going to be up for a week or so. I think that's lovely.
Yeah, they're based in Logan Square. They did over $1 million revenue in last year, so that's cool.
I really like, I love the narrative in the story about the secrecy that even in a time when we think of the big competitive cutthroat business coming from large corporate chains of grocery stores, this idea of complete secrecy, because you cannot let the other grocery store know that, you know, cabbage is going to be on sale this week, and you have to closely guard that. I love that. I wish we had more of that. I think for as much as technology is so interesting and has made our lives, you know, simpler in so many ways, I think there's still something so lovely about things being made by hands right here in Chicago that are thriving. I love it. So everybody, definitely go to ChicagoTribune.com and check out that story. The headline on it is, "Through Nostalgia or Necessity, Hand-Painted Signs Have Persisted in Chicago." All right, we're going to take a little break and then get you to news. We'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us and sharing part of your Saturday here with me. I'm most grateful to you for that. Still lots to do on the Wintrust Business Lunch, of course. We are joined now by Mark Horner, regular contributor to this program. He's a wealth advisor and founder of Fairhaven Wealth Management. He's always full of excellent advice. Welcome back to the program, Mark. Always happy to have you.
Great to be with you, Amy.
So you have good advice for recently graduated, who I'm sure are eager to get into the workforce, get apartments, get going, set up their lives, go do all those things, and manage student debt.
Yeah, it's an exciting time and full of graduation parties, but also a great time as everybody's heading out to that first job to really get their working career off to a great start with getting the right habits and the right discipline in place. And you know, it doesn't, I'm not going to expect anybody to jump up and down and get all excited about the budgeting topic. I'm in the business and I don't like the topic. I don't like the topic either. But a really simple way for people to think about getting off to the right start is the 50-30-20 rule. So when they get that first paycheck, when they get their net take home pay, so that's their income after Uncle Sam has taken his share of their income, you divide up that money that hits the checking account 50-30-20. So 50% of that money should be allocated towards necessities, things like rent, groceries, transportation costs, and getting to work. 30% can be allocated towards the fun stuff, so going to concerts, going out to dinner with friends, and 20% should be allocated to getting started saving, and then for a lot of students dealing with student loans and college debt.
Well, I like that breakdown because sometimes when you read about budgeting advice, it's like this percent here, this percent here, and it breaks it down and it kind of itemizes your life. And I think that's why people tend to resist budgeting because it seems so restrictive.
So I completely agree with you. Again, I've been in this is my 17th year in this business. I don't want to go through my monthly expenses down to the dollar on what the cable bill costs or what I paid for gas. And so I think these rules of thumb are helpful. Now it's important to know if you go down the 50-30-20 rule, that 30% bucket, again, the fun stuff, going out with your friends, going to concerts, things like that. That's the area that's got the most flex in it. And so absolutely, even if you've got student debt, you cannot delay starting to save for intermediate term goals like buying your first house or longer term goals like saving for retirement. The power of compound interest is enormous. And so you're just going to have to go out to eat a few less times a month in order to get started saving right away.
Yeah, that's a topic you've underlined many times here on the program, and that it's so important that how compound interest works and the advantage you have for starting that savings early in your working life as opposed to midway through.
Absolutely, and I hate to be a broken record on that topic, but the numbers are just staggering. If somebody that starts saving at age 20, just the equivalent of an expensive cup of coffee a day, and just continues that pace through retirement, they will be a millionaire. If they wait just 5 years, so instead of age 20, they start saving at age 25, because you know what does 5 years matter? They could have $350,000 less. Saved for retirement over that time period. So really those small dollars compounded over time add up to big dollars.
That's significant. That is very significant for just 5 years of delay in your 20s, of what a difference that can make for sure. And I think it's probably difficult sometimes to especially as a young adult just entering the workforce, it's hard to even think of your life at retirement age, I think, at that point. So simplifying it like this, I'm sure, is very, very helpful to a lot of your clients and even their children.
We think so, and I think it does come back to just getting started with good habits and good discipline. Because I agree that the clients, when we talk to the kids of our clients and have these kinds of conversations, we make a little bit of a joke out of it because it is a little silly at some level in your early 20s to be thinking about and making decisions that I'm going to benefit from when I'm in my 60s. But again, these habits, forming good habits early are just very, very important.
Definitely. There is a thing you have talked about recently that I think is so interesting. And see, I think it's probably very underutilized, but you encourage people to negotiate things that don't seem negotiable, like your cell phone contract and utilities and things like that. I think for the most part, a lot of us just go, okay, that's the price. Okay, fair enough.
Right, I agree, and I would say it's okay to go into your professional life with the attitude that everything's negotiable. That the worst that can happen if you ask the question is just they'll say no. So I'd say there's relatively little downside. So for recent grads that maybe are coming off mom and dad's gym membership and they're going to go join their own gym, it's absolutely go into that membership office and say, hey, I'm a recent grad. I'm just getting started. I want to stay healthy. I want to continue the gym membership. It's just not in my budget. Is there anything that you can do for me? And put it back on them. Let the organizations make the decisions and try and think creatively about how they can find a way to keep a client. Because for any company, keeping existing clients, it makes a lot more sense than trying to replace clients. And so that's true at the gym. I encourage clients to talk to their cell phone provider, car dealerships. When it's time to buy your first car, they often have deals for new college grads. But go ahead and ask the question. Worst case is get an answer or no.
Right. That's the worst. That's the worst that can happen. They can't put you in jail for asking, for sure.
No, absolutely not.
And then what about insurance? Because I know that's a topic that I think, kind of like savings, it's hard to even think of worst case scenarios. It's hard to even think of end of life decisions, stuff like that. But you generally advise that conversation to start pretty early too.
Well, so that one, Amy, is more about trying to help younger people avoid some mistakes. And so I had this experience, and I know this is probably going to resonate with a lot of your listeners, that when I first graduated from college, a few of my classmates got jobs in the insurance business. And one of the business development strategies that the insurance companies use is they ask their agents to put together, their newly minted agents, to put together a list of family and friends. And then they go out and talk to the family and friends about life insurance. Well, as a recent college grad in your early 20s, number one, many employers offer some level of complimentary life insurance. It just comes along as part of your benefit package. But life insurance it should be a rather low priority for that recent college grad. It absolutely is a part of a comprehensive financial plan, but it should be saved for later down the road. So maybe at that first home purchase, at a marriage, arrival of children. Those are lifetime milestones where it makes more sense to look at life insurance. And so we discourage younger people that we talk to from getting any additional life insurance beyond what might come with their employer benefit package.
Sure, especially I think if it's like the pitch is coming from a friend.
Yeah, that's tough. So I'd say, you know, let them practice their pitch.
Right.
But you know, that's okay. Let them practice their pitch, but I defer those conversations to later. Far more important to get that, if there's any student loan debt, get that knocked away. Absolutely much more important to get started saving in that company sponsored retirement plan. And if they've got a Roth option in a 401k plan, absolutely, young people should jump all over either a Roth 401k, or if a 401k is not available at their employer, establishing their own Roth IRA. So and the reason for that is contributions to Roth, either 401k or IRAs, are after tax, so you pay taxes today, but they are protected from income taxes for the rest of your life, and actually the life of your heirs, so for two lifetimes. So for somebody that's just starting in their first career, typically as their career progresses, they're gonna advance and make more money. So that means to pay income taxes today at what would be a lower rate and protect that money from income taxes for the future makes a ton of sense.
Certainly. And what other maybe common missteps do you see from people early in their careers, just getting their financial house in order, that just makes you cringe every time?
Well, you know, I think something that maybe has been an offshoot of the 2008 economic difficulties, mm-hmm. that we had is that people have gotten a little gun shy about the use of credit. And credit has its place, again, in anybody's financial plan. It needs to be used responsibly, but I think it's important for younger people to go ahead and get a credit card, establish that credit history, because when it comes time to buy that first house, very few of us are going to be able to pay cash for a house. We're going to need a mortgage, and mortgage companies are going to want to see some credit history. And it's surprising, you know, one of our clients is a professional athlete. He came out of college, very nice income, had never had credit before, and we had to do some work in order to get him approved for a credit card, which was a little surprising given his financial profile. So I would encourage young people to think about credit in moderation and in balance, but it's a tool to be used that you're going to need later in life. So go ahead and get started with that right now.
That's an important example that you gave, I think, right there, because you think, oh, well, if someone's a professional athlete, they're probably making really good money. They wouldn't need, you know, that probably would overshadow need for credit history. So that's interesting that you mentioned how essential that was for him.
Yeah, and then the only thing I'd throw out for younger people is that we've had in working with in our business with college interns over the course of the year, it's very important. So this is a non-financial item, mm-hmm. but in getting that first job started, to really be paying attention to detail. So things like spelling, things like grammar, when you're putting together an analysis for your manager or your boss, to really make sure that you're making a very good first impression. And using, I think it's F7 on the keyboard is the hot key for spell check. But make sure you're making a good impression with your new boss because they are paying attention to things as small as grammar, spelling, correct punctuation, things like that. I mean, it may sound a little silly, but that stuff absolutely matters in the work world.
Oh, does it ever? That's for sure. And you never know when you are going to cross paths with people from that internship later on in your career.
You do not. It's a small world.
Indeed it is. Well, Mark Horner, thanks so much for being with us. Wealth advisor and founder of Fairhaven Wealth Management right here in Chicagoland. Have yourself a fine weekend, Mark. Always nice to talk with you.
And to you, Amy.
Take care. All right, we're going to take a little break and back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Wrapping things up here. At 1 o'clock, we're going to turn it over to the Startup Showcase. Lots of tech-nory stuff to be talking about. You know, a little earlier in the show, we were talking with New York Times reporter Connor Doherty about this really interesting uptick in non-compete clauses with employees that is really, really interesting because it, you know, as we were talking with him about how it's something that we've kind of long accepted as fairly normal, but not often enforced, but mostly something that just is happening around more high profile, senior executives, things like that. But lately we've been seeing this with more junior employees, even hourly wage employees. He mentioned someone who is shoveling dirt. He mentioned Jimmy John's employees, things like that, these are getting enforced. But during that conversation, he mentioned Yahoo. He was talking about how it's sort of the natural selection, how companies ebb and flow, and some the smaller ones, as they run their course, they will be sometimes absorbed by larger companies, or they'll dissolve, and something more innovative will pave the way. I'm thinking like how Facebook overtook MySpace, things like that, right?
Yeah, he mentioned it was like a slightly ugly thing to say, but
yeah,
when a weak business is sometimes should need to die or something.
Yeah,
like
he
that,
said
which
it,
is hard to say, but
right. But I see
in
what
a
he was saying.
View of
right,
the economy.
That things need to. There is a circle of life in the economy, indeed. But he mentioned Yahoo and Google in particular. How Yahoo used to have all this market share and really a lot of clout in that space, but now Google is so very much the owner of that space that we even use Google as the verb, even if we're not using Google. No matter what engine we're using to search, we say, well, Google it, right?
Yep.
But there is an interesting story when you dig into Yahoo a little bit and how it's changing and shrinking. So even though it has declined, and if you look at the numbers attached to it, the staff shrank by almost 50%, like all these numbers just way, way, way down.
With those two huge hacks of their
right.
user database.
They've had so many things. It's just kind of one thing after another. But interestingly, despite that, and with Verizon on the horizon, that rhymed. I didn't want it to.
I like it.
Verizon on the horizon, about to. I did not plan that. About to they're going to absorb them.
Yep.
Yeah, I was going to say merge, but it's even more than that.
No, yeah, they're just buying it.
Verizon is taking over Yahoo. So despite these declines, despite all that, Marissa Mayer, who has been in the news a lot around women and workplace stuff, we've talked about her a lot. She has been a controversial figure on some of the stances she's taken on parental leave and things like that, because she gave birth to twins and was back at work almost immediately. So a lot of people had a lot of things to say about that. Anyway, despite this decline at Yahoo, despite Verizon buying them, she made an unbelievable amount of money, as did shareholders. And it's because of Verizon's, because of Alibaba, which is like Amazon in China, because they own that. And it is really fascinating. There's
just a percentage.
Yeah,
of
it's
it.
Not even it's the whole thing. It's just like
right,
a piece
yeah.
of it.
Yeah.
There's a story at the New York Times that does kind of a dissection of this, and it's the headline, Dissecting Marissa Mayer's $900,000 a week Yahoo paycheck, which is unfathomable to think of $900,000 at all, much less in a week.
Right, and most of her pay coming from those stocks and stock options that she had.
Yeah.
And
as a result of the Alibaba.
So if shareholders are doing well, she's doing well, and they did very well. It compared to tech companies like you listed that have been thriving while Yahoo is really suffering in the past 4 or 5 years, it's comparable, sometimes much better for shareholders at Yahoo than it has been at those places. It's very bizarre.
It's really interesting because it's not the typical narrative of a tech company, of any company, much less a tech one. When it starts to decline, it starts to decline. It becomes kind of this race to the bottom of cutting costs and finding, diversifying revenue and all of these things. And I feel like we talk about that almost every single week on the show. Some company in some different industry having to make some hard choices as like a disruptor comes in, as something has changed the industry, as a bigger company comes in to do something in a more innovative way. It's a story we've seen again and again, but rarely is it the case that that the shareholders and the CEO are making an unbelievable amount of money as it's happening, as the decline is happening, and as it's being absorbed by a larger company.
Yeah, and you have to wonder what the future is for Yahoo, how those shareholders feel about that money, if they feel safe in it. I mean, they're probably enjoying it very much, but
I think
future is very uncertain, because even as this money is coming in, the company's suffering on sort of a user level.
Oh, definitely.
That doesn't make you feel good. So I think that after the sale settles,
it's probably a cash in your chips and go home sort of deal. Yeah.
And certainly uncertain future. So
yeah, definitely. Yeah. We'll keep talking about this on the show for sure, because it is interesting. Anytime there's a story this high profile that does not follow the typical narrative and doesn't follow the path you think it's going to follow, or has a surprise like, well, people are making a lot of money on the inside of it. It is certainly a topic we want to explore. So that about does it for us this week on the Business Lunch. Catch Steve Bertrand all week long, and then I'm back here next Saturday, noon to 1, but I'll be back here tonight on WGN, 7 to 9 p.m. for the Saturday night special. We're talking a little bit about Wonder Woman and some other comic books tonight, so please stick around for that. All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news, all that good stuff, here in just a bit on 720 WGN.